Buenos días, good morning. How is everybody? I gotta give you guys credit, man. Y'all start at 8:30 in the morning. That's bananas. I was like, wow. Still trying to drop off my kids at school. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I'm really excited, one, to share in such an amazing conversation with such amazing leaders of thought in our work. As was mentioned, my name is Kim Wasserman, and I'm the Director of Organizing and Strategy at the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization, located right down the road, right down I-55. If you see the big coal power plants, when you look west, you'll see our very lovely neighborhoods of Pilsen and Little Village. So I just wanted to paint a little bit of a picture as to who we are as a community and why we're here to have this conversation with folks today. So Little Village is 95,000 people total within five-mile radius of an area. We are the Mexican capital of the Midwest. We are the second largest population of Mexican and Mexican-Americans outside of East Los Angeles. So there is a whole lot of people living in our neighborhood, and of the 95,000 people, half of them are under the age of 25. So we have a lot of young people in our neighborhood. And I think this gives you a really great idea of kind of not only culturally speaking, but also food-wise. We are, if you happen to be in Chicago for the rest of the week and want to come down and try one of our 166 amazing restaurants, we highly recommend that you do. a lot of great food in our neighborhood. Also very culturally representative, as I mentioned. Tons of murals, tons of art, tons of folks in the street, a very walkable community that speaks volumes to what it's like to be Chicana in the Midwest. How do we maintain our culture? How do we maintain our community? You know, Chicago is an incredibly segregated city, but to be able to find pockets like La Villita, Little Village, where the culture and community stand strong is incredibly exciting. And the other thing about us is our main thoroughway, which is 26th Street, is actually second behind Michigan Avenue in tax revenue, yet we have no big boxes in our community. So what you'll find is a lot of small mom-and-pop stores and no Walmarts, no Targets, none of that happening in our neighborhood, which I think, again, speaks volumes to the kind of close community that we have. And Michigan Avenue, just so you know, has the Prada, the Nike, the Tiffany, and all of the big names, whereas we don't. We have Paraderias and Taquerias and, you know, currency exchanges and all kinds of other small economy stores. But really the reason I'm here today to talk about is some of the environmental justice work that we've been able to do in the last 20 years in our community. So as was mentioned, one of the biggest campaigns that we worked on and were successful in winning in 2012 was the closure of the Crawford and Fisk coal power plants here in Chicago. That was a 12-year campaign to shut down two of the dirtiest coal power plants in the nation that happened to be located in a major metropolitan area of Chicago. And unfortunately, it took us 12 years to be able to even create policy that would tackle this issue. And in this day and age, that's incredible. Be hard to believe that it takes 12 years to create policy that protects human health over a company that didn't supply electricity to the city, didn't supply electricity to the state, didn't employ anybody in our neighborhood, yet managed to kill 40 people a year, cause over 1,500 asthma attacks a year, and over 5,000 emergency room visits just in our neighborhood alone. So when we closed them, I think it really stood strong to kind of what we're thinking about as a community and how we value our health and our people as a neighborhood. But that wasn't the only victory we had. We also won a brand new park in our neighborhood. 95,000 people, only one park for our community. Let me repeat that, only one park for our community when half of our folks are under the age of 25. So we had a fight for a new park, and living in a city like Chicago, it's not like we have vast vacant land to pick from. We're not out in the country. We have nothing but industrial legacy land to pick from. So in our case, we had to pick a Superfund site. And I called it a Superfund, not a Superfund site. Let me be very clear on that as well, because it takes an astronomical amount of money to clean up these sites. So this is a picture of one of our former young people who is now in his mid-20s and has kids, when he was 15 years old on the site, finding out that it was a Superfund site and bringing that to the attention of not just the community, but also to the organization where we battled. And so this is what the park looks like now. It was actually opened up this year and is completely done. And it took us 15 years to get it. And it was designed by the community, not by the park district, by the community. Because what the park district brought us was a park design that had nothing but soccer fields in it, because apparently as brown people, the only thing that we play is soccer. And so we had a fight to get basketball courts, to get other amenities besides just soccer in our park. And I will say that if you notice, the one thing that's missing on this park is a field house. right? 8 months out of the year, it's incredibly cold here in Chicago, and apparently they expect folks to be outside in below 30 degrees playing in the park. So literally next month, we're going to be launching our campaign to now fight for a field house, and our goal is it does not take us 15 years to get the field house like it took us 15 years to get the park. The third campaign that we won was the extension of a bus line. In our neighborhood, there was a 3-mile gap where you could not get public transit bus service going east to west, and living in a city like Chicago, a 3-mile gap is an incredibly large gap to have to live with. If you're elderly, if you're sick, if you have children, navigating a 3-mile gap is almost life-threatening a lot of times. So we worked for 5 years to get a new bus line in our neighborhood, and we were successful. When Chicago Transit Authority was in a deficit, we were able to get a new bus line in our community. Finally, one of the last campaigns that we won was a new urban farm in our neighborhood. A lot of our organizing is done around food. People love food. They love to come together and talk around food. And so we've done a lot of gardens in our neighborhood, but this was our first quarter-acre garden in size. And 2 years ago, we finally were able to move into the site and start our urban agriculture program. And so I share these victories with you because we are at a point now as an organization, I'm very thankful to say, after 20 years of fighting and having won such amazing victories, to be able to stop and reflect. And I apologize, I was actually doing this presentation in Spanish, and so the book title is in Spanish, so my apologies. But this is a great book written by Carrie Leiterson. It talks about the shutdown of the coal power plants and really talks about the campaign that we worked on. And from 2013 to 2015, we spent a lot of time reflecting as an organization. We had been reactive for so long. We reacted to air pollution. We reacted to not having open space. We reacted to not having a bus. The conversation really became, when do we become, one, proactive, but number two, more importantly, how do we understand the decisions that allowed a coal power plant to be in our community? How do we understand the decisions that allowed us not to get a park for 15 years and didn't give us the public transit that we needed? And what we found was at the heart of a lot of this conversation was planning and policy. Because in a city like Chicago, because we don't look at health and environment as part of that narrative or through an environmental justice lens, we end up with communities like the Little Village community, where we don't have the basic necessities that we need, and we're living constantly with threats to our environment. So you fast forward, right? We won these amazing victories in our community. The city is currently doing a land use plan in our neighborhood, and what are they seeing? They're seeing a growth in our economy on transportation and warehousing. That's great to know that there is an actual growth of economy in our neighborhood. But the question becomes, again, when you look at that growth and you don't take into account health and environment, you end up with situations like this, which is you have a company like Unilever who's making mayonnaise at a local plant right next door to an elementary school, and they want to expand. Apparently mayonnaise is doing very well these days. Everybody is getting their fair share of mayonnaise. They want to bring in 500 additional trucks a day to their facility and to their warehouse, which is great. Kudos for them for growing. But what happens when those 500 trucks are right next door to a public school that has 1,000 school-aged children between kindergarten and eighth grade? Where does the protection that they deserve come into play? Where does the air quality issues, the filters, the possible solutions come into conversation? And so now as an organization, we find ourselves being proactive and jumping into this conversation, because if we don't protect our children, nobody will protect our children. As is seen in this case, Unilever has been approved for their expansion, and there is no conversation whatsoever on how those children's health is going to be protected. And we're not the only community. On the southeast side, you have the southeast community dealing with pet coke, because somebody decided that it was okay to put large piles of pet coke, a byproduct of tar sands, out in the open in front of, literally right across the street from people's homes. And so that community actually today is having a huge protest and rally at 4 o'clock on the southeast side to fight back against the pet coke placed in their community. And in Pilsen, which is a neighborhood right next door to ours, you have a high school that has a metal shredder planned to go right across the street from their school. And this is not just a high school. This is a high school with a health care clinic in it and a daycare in it as well. And so, again, the question becomes, when we look at land use plans and we look at policy plans and we're not looking at them through an environmental justice lens, we continue to exacerbate the problems that we're fighting on a regular basis in our communities, and we never end this vicious cycle of environmental injustice in our communities. Same thing for warehousing. You know, right now our communities are being sold on jobs. Jobs, I feel like Oprah, jobs for everybody. Everybody gets a job. which is great, right? But at what cost, right? As a truck driver, when will making money go to all that money going to your healthcare or your kids' healthcare or sick days, right? So this is the narrative that we try to bring as an environmental justice organization to the conversation. So this is a great example, actually, of a partnership with ELPC here in Chicago, Environmental Law and Policy Center, where they had an air monitor, and they were looking for communities who wanted an air monitor. And we said, hey, we'd like an air monitor. We have a Unilever project right down the street from us. And so this past September, we worked with our young people and our community members to install an air monitor for 2 weeks between the facilities and the school to try to understand, at the very least, what is it that we're dealing with now and how is that going to change with an additional 500 trucks coming into our neighborhood. And the reason I say that I bring this up is because for us as a community, we really want to try to find a different model. I think you heard a lot of folks up here talk about different models. What is a different model aside from just transportation and warehousing? What are our strengths as a community? And as a community, our local economy is our strength, right? We have tons of food vendors, tons of artisans. As I mentioned, 166 restaurants in our community alone. And this is not just in our neighborhood. These folks are going from the north side to the south side, from the east side to the west side, selling different types of products and different types of food. Amazing bakers in our neighborhood. Again, a very closed-loop small economy. If you remember the picture of the garden that I first showed you, this is what our garden looks like today, right? So a very different picture of what we're doing in our community. Right now, our garden has 13 master gardeners. They're unpaid, just people from our community who come out every day and teach us how to grow our own food, how to take care of the soil, how to take care of the plants, how to understand what is happening to them. I don't have a green thumb. I'm a city girl, born and raised, product of Chicago Public Schools. I have no idea how to plant anything. But I take their advice, and I'm like, hey, y'all know better than I do. Please teach me what I'm doing wrong. And we grow an immense amount of food in our garden, of which a lot of it is for free for our, actually all of it is for free for our community members. We don't charge our community members for the food that they grow in their garden. They can take it home and do what they want with it. But what we do with a lot of the food in our garden is we host a free community dinner every Wednesday night in the summer. From spring to fall, every Wednesday night, our community garden is open for folks to come in and have different conversations. This is a woman who sells food in our neighborhood, and she sets up shop on the corner, and she is throwing, if you see her, I highly recommend you stop and eat her food. She is throwing down on a regular basis, and that is how she provides income to her family in our community. And we talk about different things, and we talk about climate change, and we talk about how the environment is impacting us, but we do it around culturally relevant topics. So for instance, this is our salsa competition, the eating salsa, not the dancing salsa. And this is where folks come out and fight for the molcajete de oro, or the mortar and pestle of gold. And it is a highly contentious fight. This is a lady who won this year. And you best believe that these ladies are no joke, because they're not just coming to show their salsa. They're coming to make connections with what is happening in our community all the way down to Mexico in regards to environment. And so again, we do these sessions because it allows us to really talk about the impacts of climate change, how we're feeling, and more importantly, what are the solutions that we're looking for in our communities. Our communities deal with flooding, on a regular basis. And so just real quickly, what we do is we work with our young people, we work with our folks to really try to figure out not only what are the impacts, but what are the solutions. Because for us as a community, if we are not rooted in those solutions, what is going to happen is we are going to be displaced and gentrified as a community. Why? Because we now have clean air. We now have a great park. We now have great public transit. So when nobody wanted to live in our neighborhood before, everybody and their mama wants to now live in our neighborhood because it's a great neighborhood, which is great. We're excited. But this is the things that we fought for as a community, and we deserve the right to stay in our neighborhood and enjoy them. And so we work with our young people, as I mentioned, to do everything from riverwalk development, where we're taking industry's backyard and making it our community's front yard, to understanding green infrastructure so that our young people are lining themselves up to get the jobs to do the green infrastructure in our neighborhood so that they feel rooted in our neighborhood and they won't be displaced out of our neighborhood. And these are young people who worked on not just the shutdown of the coal power plant, but everything through that we just talked about. And again, this is the idea that we have around a local food system for us as a community. So if our folks are growing food, they can sell it to the street vendors. The street vendors can give us back their waste product. The waste product can go to our worm composters. The worm composters are growing the soil for the farmers, and the farmers are then growing food for the restaurants and everybody in our community. And so that's one way for us to give to the economy, have a solution, have a low-carbon solution, and really build on our strengths as a community. And so these are our young people getting ready for their worm composting. medicinal herbs that folks put together in bundles to sell in the neighborhood for all kinds of different problems that you have. Commercial kitchens for our street vendors. Chicago just authorized or just allowed permitted food vendors for the first street vendors for the first time in history. So where are these folks supposed to go if we don't have commercial kitchens in our neighborhood? So we're looking at a model of cooperatives for commercial kitchens in our neighborhood where we can make amazing food locally grown, locally sustained for our community members. And so the question really becomes, we are an amazing neighborhood, one of many, that is creating sustainability plans, that is looking to bring health to the conversation because we don't know it all. But what we do know is that we have all of the answers in our neighborhood, and it's not a blanket approach to what is happening, and that we need to be looking at policies that help our community, not hinder our community. And I apologize, I know I'm going long, but the last thing I really, really want to say is that it's not just about the environment. It's about planning, it's about development, it's about economic development, but it's also about juvenile justice. So the last thing I want to say to folks is, in our neighborhood, you grew up, you either had a coal power plant that you were looking at, or you had Cook County Jail that you were looking at, because we are home also to Cook County Jail, the largest metropolitan jail in the United States. And so if we're not talking about how our young people are being targeted and the school-to-jail pipeline as part of that narrative, we are doing our young people a serious injustice by not including that as part of the narrative. So we make that connection all the way through the 43 students missing in Mexico, because these are real things that are happening and affecting our community and are part of the conversation on environmental justice. So the last thing I can say is there can be no environmental justice without social justice, and I do hope that helps folks think about the policy framework as you move forward to not just be limited to health, but really think about health in the broadest terms. Thank you very much.